Play to Potential podcast.
Welcome to the 8th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast series. My guest this time is Viren Raskina, a former captain of the Indian field hockey team. He quit hockey when he was in his prime and went to ISB to pursue his MBA. After completing his MBA, he joined the Olympic Gold Quest in 2009 and has been the CEO since. OGQ has played a key role in 5 out of the 8 medals India has won in the last 2 Olympics, at London and in Rio. In our conversation, we spoke about a range of topics, including how he thought about his career and transitions at different points in time, how they pick Olympic gold medalists of the future at OGQ, and what they do to cultivate these sportsmen to go and perform at the biggest stage. Without further ado, over to the conversation. Viren, thank you so much for your time. Pleasure to be talking to you.
Thank you.
Maybe a good place to start, Viren, is to talk about the Olympic Gold Quest, the organization where you're the CEO. So give us an insight into what is OGQ, and more specifically, how could people contribute to OGQ? The reason I say is a lot of us clearly are passionate about India winning medals at the Olympics, but often don't know how to meaningfully contribute. So give us an insight into just the organization, and also touch upon how people could think about contributing to this cause.
Olympic Gold Quest is a not-for-profit organization. It was founded by two of our sports legends, Geet Sethi and Prakash Padukone, who need no introduction. The mission of OGQ is a very sharp one. It is to help Indian athletes win Olympic gold medals. We are very proud to say that in the last 2 Olympics at London 2012 and Rio 2016, 5 out of the 8 medal winners for India, which is Gagan Narang, Vijay Kumar, MC Mary Kom, Saina Nehwal, and now this time in Rio PV Sindhu, their training was supported by Olympic Gold Quest.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you. And when I say the training was supported by OGQ, this is in terms of helping provide the best coaches for them, the best training facilities for them, ensuring they have the best equipment. We have put together a team of world-class doctors, physios, nutritionists, mental trainers, everything in the back end to ensure that these athletes have the best possible support. Because if we expect our athletes to win Olympic medals, everyone working in behind the scenes also needs to be world-class. We can't expect Mary Kom to have to win an Olympic medal with an average coach or average physio. So everyone needs to perform their role to the best of their ability. Everyone needs to be the best at what they do. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the journey to helping us winning Olympic medals. And it's not that it's not happening currently, but the scope to do much better. OGQ supports some of the best young talent in the country. Currently, we support the training and preparation of 93 athletes mm-hmm. across 8 different individual Olympic sports. Mm-hmm. These sports are badminton, boxing, shooting, athletics, archery, wrestling, swimming, and table tennis. Mm-hmm. These are the sports that we have identified where India has the potential to win Olympic medals. And when resources are limited, generally you must create priorities.
Sure.
So looking at historical data, our relative strengths and weaknesses against the best in the world, sports where we have the best talent and potential, that's how we have narrowed down on these sports. Out of those 93 athletes, around 42 are senior athletes 20 years and above who are preparing for the Tokyo 2020 Olympics. Mm-hmm. Around 51 are junior athletes, 19 years and below, who we are grooming for 2024 and 2028 Olympics.
Wow.
So there are short-term plans now for Tokyo 2020 as well as long-term plans for 8 years and 12 years for the remaining Olympics. And incidentally, the youngest athlete we support is an 8-year-old girl. She plays badminton.
Fascinating. And any thoughts on how people could think about being a part of this journey with you?
Yeah, I wanted to mention one more point even PV Sindhu, who won the Olympic silver medal this time, not many people know that OGQ has been supporting her training since the time she was 14 years old. And in fact, when she was 15 years old, Olympic Gold Quest had sent her for 5 international tournaments. At that time, she wasn't in the Indian team. Her parents could not afford to send her for international tournaments. And that time, we incurred an expenditure of almost 15 lakhs to send her for tournaments with a coach or her parent or a physio, etc.
Wow.
So, we've been supporting her since then. And the journey with Sindhu to win an Olympic medal was 7 long years.
Fascinating.
And, you know, that's what makes it really fulfilling to be a part of the journey. Generally, in sport, people only see the final destination.
Correct.
But I think the journey is something that has given us a lot of pride and pleasure. And, you know, we would love for more and more people to be a part of this journey. As I said, Olympic Gold Quest is a not-for-profit organization. We raise funds only through donations.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, many companies as well as HNIs support us. So, we have both the 50% tax deduction as well as 100% tax deduction certificates. We are CSR compliant, mm-hmm. so companies support us through CSR as well. But we also have many individuals supporting us with donations as little as 500 or 1,000 rupees.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the eventual dream is for the masses to support an organization like OGQ. I think every contribution counts. And we believe that sport is something that cuts across all barriers.
True.
If you watched Sindhu's final at Rio, and you would have felt proud on TV that as an Indian athlete is competing toe to toe with the best in the world.
Absolutely.
And you know, we want people to contribute towards that and make a difference. Very often, people want to support sport, but they do not know how to. And OGQ wants to be that platform where people can support, and we can ensure that the support goes towards an organization that is credible, that is accountable, that is transparent and showing impact. And as I said, we look after the training of the best of the best young talent in the country. These are the talented athletes who can potentially 8-10 years down the line go on to win Olympic medals for India. And we want a million people to be a part of that journey.
And to make it tactical, Viren, what's the easiest way for people to contribute? Is there a website and is there an online payment?
Our website is olympicgoldquest.in.
Okay.
And you can log on to our website. Simply click on contribute now. And okay. You can make an online donation via debit card, credit card, NEFT, whatever mode you prefer. So there are 3 options for donating. It's as simple as that.
Got it.
It'll take a maximum of 2 minutes to do that.
Very interesting. And maybe just to rewind the clock, Viren, I want to talk about your journey. And a lot of people, especially with income challenges, might end up picking the safe option and going to academics to ensure at least, you know, they have the base case covered. What's been your journey through that phase? And what's the advice you give to people who are at those crossroads where they have to make a choice between committing to the sport versus playing it safe?
You know, in India, traditionally, when you come to 10th standard or 12th standard, you always have to make a choice in life.
Correct.
And, you know, I came from a background where exactly you had to make the choice, because my mom was a doctor and dad was an engineer. 2 elder brothers were computer engineers. So
sure.
I didn't come from a background of my family playing sport.
Uh-huh.
My family was sports loving, but they didn't play sport competitively.
Slight difference.
right. So, in fact, I myself also was on the Mumbai merit list in SSC.
Okay.
And, you know, but I just knew in my mind that at that point of time, in all honesty, I didn't understand a single scientific equation.
Okay.
And, you know, I saw my mother's big medical books, and I saw my brother's even bigger engineering books. And I thought that, you know, that's not for me. And so when I was in 10th standard, while the world and its uncle wanted me to study and become a doctor or a engineer. All I wanted to do was play hockey.
Got it.
And coincidentally, when I was 27 years old and I retired, and I eventually retired from the sport very early, possibly before my time, the world and its uncle wanted me to play for another 4 years while I wanted to study.
Very interesting.
So things reversed 12 years later. And but you know, it's just something about me following my heart always. And I have to admit here that I was very lucky, because you know, like all parents, my parents were very strict with my eldest brother. You know, so he had to do engineering. Second guy, okay, but he went into that line as well. And I think they were just not bothered about me. So, you know, I was lucky enough that I could do whatever I wanted. So, but having said that, I think for some reason, I don't know why, but I just always backed myself. And I just made one decision that since playing hockey was my choice, I wouldn't take a single penny from my parents to play the game. And when I was out of 10th standard, I was taken by Tata Sports Club hockey team on a contract when I was in 11th standard. So I used to get a princely sum of 2,000 rupees, which was a huge amount at that point of time. And, you know, when I was going to junior college and, you know, sure. I was the only one from all my friends who was earning 2,000 rupees. So a big sum of money back then as pocket money. So, you know, one thing just led to the other, and I ended up here. So I can say that I've never been someone who has thought long term, and I never thought that I would want to play for India or I would captain. You know, I dreamt of that. But you know how with young kids, you want to dream about something, but you don't actually believe at that point of time that it will happen.
Sure.
It'll actually happen.
Sure.
So I never looked at it as a career then. I just love playing hockey. I love playing sport. And now I know that I just want to be in sport. Sport is what I know best. Sport is what I love best. I mean, here at OGQ, every single day that I'm at work, I love what I do. And it's you know, there's not been a single morning that I can remember where I say, you know, oh God, I don't want to go to work.
Sure.
And I'm not enjoying this, and it's painful. And
got it.
So for me, as long as I'm dealing with sport, I'm really very happy.
In your journey, you were a part of the Indian team, and then you went on to captain the Indian team in hockey. What's that delta from being a good player to a good captain? In your experience, personal experience, but also when you see players rise from the level of a player to a captain, what's your view on what are some of the skills that sort of muscles that need to be built to make that jump?
I think one is that you have to have certain skill sets that win you the respect of your team.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be playing. You don't necessarily need to be the best player in the team, but you need to be the best in your role. So in a cricket team, you can't have 11 guys who are good batsmen, or you can't.
Sure.
There's a balance that needs to be brought to a team. You need good batsmen and good bowlers and good all-rounders and a wicketkeeper.
Sure.
Same with hockey, right?
Sure.
So I was a defensive midfielder. In my 180 matches, I never scored a single goal for India. But I was good in, I was the best in my role as a defensive midfielder. And I think that's important, that your role in the team should be well defined. You should be the best, and you should, your skills, your skill set should win you the respect.
Okay.
I think it really helps if your communication is good with the team, both one-on-one as well as with the entire team as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
I think third, it's important to be fair to everyone. That's important. And last but not the least, I would say it's important for the captain to lead by example. So if it's pushing yourself in training every single day, pushing the team, and going through the hard grind every single day, every single team meeting, every single training session, every single match, and that's that's something that was that came very naturally to me. I've always been extremely determined and push myself every single day. I will not be happy if I give anything less than 100% in whatever I do. So I do few things, but I make sure that I do it really well. So I think for me, again, I've been lucky that I've always got along with everyone. I've never, you know, I love being around people. I hate doing anything in isolation. I don't care if I'm the team leader or not, but I just love to be part of a team.
Got
so,
it.
Yeah.
And as you look around, again, if you were to give your views on what differentiates the great captains from the good captains, where is sometimes the edge that some captains have who sort of go on to become really legendary?
I think it's just about your personal rapport and inspiration. And I think that's what I said about you have to be good not just with one-on-one with an individual, but with getting the best out of the individual as well as the team as a whole. Because finally the team needs to be better or bigger than the sum of its parts.
Got it.
And you don't need the big names and the big stars in the team always. And you must understand that everyone cannot be the star in the team. There might be one, two or three of them in a team of 16. But together, when you bring that entire team together, the final output should be more than the sum of the individuals.
Got it.
And it's a skill set of the captain and the coach to bring out that best, to inspire them. And it's about dealing with people and individuals. And we must remember that every individual is different. So you might need to give galis to one guy, or you might need to put an arm around the shoulder of of another guy. But I think understanding the mentality and the attitude of people is something that's very important.
Got it. You alluded to betting on people over a 10-year time frame, 12-year time frame, or even when you spoke about Sindhu. You really started working with her about 7 years back, you said, and it took 7 long years to get to the podium at the Olympics. How do you spot potential? Right, and I think you said that even when she was not a part of the Indian team, you'd sponsored her to go and play tournaments. So how do you look for that spark for you to say, I will invest behind this person? Because the reason I ask is, this is a real a challenge in a lot of companies where you're always looking for those diamonds in the rough, right? And how do you really pick them?
So a combination of factors, really. One is quantitative factors. So we have a full-fledged research team that would be researching into quantitative results over the last 2 to 3 years of the athlete. So what are the kind of results? What age is the athlete? What are the best in the world doing? What were they doing when they were that age?
Okay. So it's normalized to what is expected.
Absolutely. Also, we need to understand what kind of coaching, support, equipment, etc. that the athlete had, right? So if for an archer, if the archer didn't have the right kind of equipment, he or she is not going to get the same kind of results.
Given the constraints, okay.
Yeah, given those constraints. If they didn't have a proper technical coach supporting him or her, again, it would be difficult to get those results. So we try to bring together all these factors. We would also see qualitative factors, like the discipline of the player, the commitment of the player. For me, a very important quality is the hunger and desire to be the best in the world. And not just being happy with being national champion or Commonwealth Games champion. We want our athletes to dream and have the desire to be the best in the world. And for that, we need to gauge whether are they ready to run through a brick wall for you every single day in training.
And you said one of your players is 8 years old, the youngest player.
Yes, yes.
So how do you smell this at somebody so young?
So again, you know, it's hard to pinpoint, because for someone that young, there's very little research data available to us, because
exactly.
The data points are very little. She's
correct.
Hardly played tournaments.
Correct.
She's not played any, not had any international exposure.
Right.
So it's a combination of, we are talking about exceptional talent.
Sure.
So these players who are 8, when Sindhu was 11, she was already beating 15-year-olds. This young kid is 8 years old, but she's already beating 11 and 12 year olds.
Understood.
And you must remember that at a young age, every 6 months plays a major difference to your progress.
Understood.
Especially physically.
8 versus 11 is a much bigger deal than 11 versus 14.
Even an 8 versus an 8 and a half year old is a big difference. So you can imagine between an 8 and an 11 year old.
Got it.
So so that's one thing. But also, I think to a large extent, you also go by gut.
Sure.
And I never ignore the gut instinct about a player. You know, science cannot actually explain that as such.
True.
But it's something that you balance out and, you know, happy to take risks.
Sure.
It's important. What we say is that it's important to get the talented people under our umbrella and create good habits in them.
Understood.
When I say good habits, I'm not talking about, you know, ensuring they don't drink or smoke or things like that. Good habits in terms of training and following the right procedures, right systems. We want to create the right ecosystem which is conducive to excellence and not a system that is conducive to mediocrity and average performances. If we get that ecosystem right, over a period of time, that ecosystem will produce results.
Sure.
So at 8, 9, 10, maybe when Sindhu was a 14-year-old, there were other girls who were better than her at 14-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
But the system will ensure that the best player in the long run will eventually come up. So we try to develop systems. We might make mistakes here or there. But in general, if someone is super talented, OGQ wants to be supporting them.
Understood. Understood. Back to your journey, Viren. If we rewinded the clock to early 2008, you retired at the peak of your game. And you alluded to the fact that when people wanted to study, you wanted to play. And people wanted you to play, you wanted to move on to study. So give us a sense of how you took stock of life at that point in time. And the reason I ask is, you know, sport in a lot of ways is a good metaphor for a lot of other professions where, you know, you're 35, 40 and suddenly you've done well, you've achieved a lot of success, but you still have the life ahead staring at you. And sometimes people struggle to take stock of life at that point in time. So walk us through just your frame of mind and how you thought about life and how you took it forward at that point in time.
So again, as I said, I came from a background where studies were important to me. It's not that because I chose sport initially that I did not want to study.
Sure.
It was always something that was important to me. I came from a background where studies were important. I think post-graduation from 21 till I was 28, I was so busy training, playing, traveling with the Indian team, I honestly did not touch a book for 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I always knew that I wanted to study and I wanted to do my MBA. I just didn't know when was the right time.
Mm-hmm.
When I was 26, I always knew that once I retired, I would do my MBA. So that decision was clear in my mind. When I was 26, 27, at that point of time, I was, you know, it had been almost 8-9 years in the Indian team. I was getting a little bit frustrated because the travel, the load, the pressure was a lot. I was getting a little bit frustrated with selection issues, with selectors, with injuries that I was having. And I felt at that point of time, you know, maybe I was not enjoying myself as much as I should have been. And, you know, that set me thinking in a way that if I'm not enjoying something at the highest, then I have no right to be there. And if I'm not feeling that I can't give 200% every single day in training, then maybe I need to think about my future. So that's what got me thinking. As far as I went to ISB to do my MBA eventually. Sure. And
was that the first batch around that time?
Or? No, the first batch was in 2001. So okay. I went in the class of 2009.
Much later, okay.
Yeah, so much later. And incidentally, in 2003 at the Afro-Asian Games in Hyderabad, where India won and we had beaten Pakistan in the final in mm-hmm. Hyderabad, mm-hmm. the Indian team was put up at ISB.
Okay.
So that's how I came to know about ISB, and I was impressed with the infrastructure, with the campus, with the curriculum, the place, and I known about ISB since then.
Sure.
And, you know, when I was planning on retiring and thinking about what to do, I knew that I always wanted to be in India. Hockey gave me the chance to go across the world and travel everywhere. But for me, I've always wanted to be in India and make a difference over here. And I didn't see myself studying for 2 years and doing an MBA abroad.
Sure.
I didn't have that much money to study abroad for 2 years. So I thought ISB, 1 year course, top class curriculum, top class peer group coming over there, great sure. faculty, great infrastructure, everything. It made good sense for me.
Sure.
I started studying for my GMAT. Simultaneously, when I was playing, I did shit in the first one. I did really well in the second one. And, and I applied to ISB. Once I got in, I decided, this is the right time for me to announce my retirement.
Fascinating. And how did OGQ come about, let's say, post-ISB? And the reason I ask is also, a lot of sportsmen move on to do other things, right? Whether it's sportsman management, commentary, bunch of possibilities open up. So give us an insight into how you took stock of the various folks ahead in front of you, and how did OGQ be born?
Yeah, so again, sometimes life just throws a few things in your path, and you don't plan for it. I never planned for OGQ. I never knew about OGQ throughout my ISB career.
How many years before you joined OGQ did it exist?
So I finished ISB in 2009.
Correct.
OGQ was actually incorporated in 2001.
Wow.
Nothing was done at all. There were no funds, no athletes, nothing. Neeraj Bharadwaj, who's one of the board of directors of OGQ, also happens to be a board of director on ISB. Mm-hmm. He was one of the founding members of ISB.
Sure.
So he had just given me a call and told me that, that we have this organization called OGQ, and I had no clue, and I actually put the phone down on him. And, at that time, the 2008-09 was the economic slump and
Lehman, post-Lehman chaos.
Yeah, post-Lehman chaos and the Satyam scandal.
Yeah.
And the dean of ISB was on the chair of Satyam.
Okay.
And, no one was getting jobs and everyone was tense. How do you pay off your educational loans? I was not interested in talking to a not-for-profit and all that sort of thing. So that's when I first heard about OGQ.
Okay.
I got a campus placement, a pretty decent package, and I was happy about that. I was ISB got over in April 2009. I was supposed to start in June 2009 in Delhi.
Uh-huh. In the corporate world.
Conventional corporate world. I would have been on exiting on Excel sheets throughout. And when I came back, the first day I came back, I happened to meet Geet and Prakash, and they told me, there's this nice organization that OGQ had, called OGQ, and they had co-founded it, and they were looking for a CEO. And I told them that I had an offer, and so right now I'm not really looking out. But I went home. It actually interested me. Because one, Geet and Prakash were asking me. In the sporting world, it's two legends asking you and people of the highest achievement, caliber, credibility. I studied a little bit about OGQ. The board was extremely credible. I thought the idea was good. The platform was good. But what really made the choice for me was, for me, there was a dream as a player to win an Olympic medal. Which I could not win when I had won, when I played the Athens 2004 Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember me at that time being very frustrated because I knew there were so many mistakes in the Indian system, the way we prepared for major competitions.
Mm.
And I had always promised myself that one day if I got the opportunity, maybe I would do things different and I would do things better.
Mm.
So it sort of, all came together at the right time. And so that's how it happened. At that time, OGQ had one athlete, Gagan Narang, and there was actually 10 lakhs in the bank. So, you know, and again, people thought that I was mad. And so, you know, history sort of repeated itself. When I was in 10th standard, they thought I was mad. When I quit from hockey, again, people thought I was mad. And when I'm taking a not-for-profit after I had a huge education loan, again, they thought I was mad. So, you know, now I'm getting sort of used to it. So, but again, I've, as I said, I've always followed my heart, followed what I thought was best. And I've been lucky enough that my parents have never interfered and they've always trusted me.
Actually, if we pause the clock at that passage of play, pardon the pun, but really, if you were to reflect on some of these transitions you've been through and sort of say, therefore, what are the two, three themes that come up that you want to share with the broader universe of people going through their careers in terms of how they should think about what next? Are there one or two themes that emerge? Just so that...
For me, I think it's a great question. And obviously, people are generally very confused in life. What to do and what to do next and when to do.
Correct.
And to be honest, I was confused as well. I was scared. I'll be lying if I was saying that, because the decision to make the transition from hockey to studies was very tough for me.
Hmm.
Because I thought, you know, I'm going to go to a school where, you know, iTeens are going to be coming and all that. And can I match up to them? Will I be able to take the load of the course?
Hmm.
But when I actually went into ISB, you realize that everyone has been in the corporate world for 5 years.
Hmm.
And everyone is scared.
Hmm.
And everyone is thinking, can I manage? But when you, you know, just jump into the pool, you somehow learn to swim.
Right.
Even if it's against the tide. And that environment, in, you know, it forces you to learn and forces you to fend for yourself.
Right.
And, you know, I realized that everyone had the fears. No one had touched a book for 5 years. So that was one thing. Ki, you need to overcome that fear of change.
Hmm.
And sometimes just take the plunge. Number two is, if you've seen, I've always done what I loved and what I wanted to do and not what someone else wanted me to do.
Hmm.
And thirdly is, back yourself and then give it everything.
Hmm.
That's something that can't be compromised on. Sometimes you will fail, and I always say that I've failed many more times than I won. But that's okay. That's okay. You will, that will happen. And you just got to keep plugging away.
And back to OGQ, again, it's been a rewarding 8 years. Now you have 5 out of 8 medal winners in the last 2 Olympics, thanks to OGQ. You spoke about how you pick talent, right? Give us an insight into what are some of the themes that emerge in terms of how you support the talent. Again, I ask this in the context of grooming leaders in a company. Right. Well, I mean, picking is a key element. You need to pick the diamonds in the rough carefully. But if you had to sort of really pick these, look at these 5 athletes who eventually went on to be on the podium at the Olympics, what are some of the themes that emerge in terms of A, player attributes, if there's any common themes, and B, anything about how the system came together to enable their success?
Yeah, so maybe a couple of quick things on this is, if you think about common elements, there was no doubt that all of them were super talented in right. their respective sport. That right. is number one. Number two is, it's very, very clear to us that at Olympic level, this plain raw talent is not enough.
Correct.
There are many factors that go into it. And the Olympic medal winner cannot do it by himself or herself. They have to be surrounded by a superb team.
Hmm.
And that's what is with everyone in the corporate world. None of us work alone. And we need to be surrounded with a good team. So that's what we ensured at OGQ.
Mm-hmm.
Each one of these athletes was surrounded by a world-class team, whether it was the physio or the trainer or the nutritionist or the coach or the guy who's booking their tickets.
Mm.
Everyone is performing his role to the best.
Mm.
And third is, that athlete and the entire team give 100% every single day, like I said, for even if it's a team meeting, if it's a training session, if it's a match. You can't compromise on all these. If all these things are brought together, your chances of winning are much more. Because right now, Olympic medals are won and lost by very, very tiny margins.
True.
And you need to ensure that your processes and systems are right. If those are right, chances of not succeeding are high, even if one thing is out of place.
Got it.
So that's what would be the common element around all these athletes. All of them fiercely, fiercely determined. Like I say, they run through a wall every single day in training. Another element would be they're not afraid of losing. They're not afraid of an opponent. They just want to give it their all. And that's the kind of athletes we want to back, who have that fierce desire, because there will be challenges. You will lose,
right?
And you got to learn the tough lessons from that defeat, ensure you don't repeat the same mistakes, and actually make it happen when it really, really matters. Because again, in the real world, real match, that opportunity comes once or twice.
True.
And that time you have to be ready, you have to be prepared, and you know, not back down and not be afraid, because if you're hesitant, you will lose.
Right. And on that point, Viren, any thoughts or lessons from the sports world on how that grit muscle can be built over time? Even when you look at the sportsman, one is sort of the intrinsics that you can't change. But is that something that can be built over time systematically? Have you sort of seen coaches do that?
I think the why is very important for every person. And what does it mean to that person? And I've seen many super talented athletes, but you know, just the why is not very clear to them. They're sort of drifting, and it's not very clear to them what is their dream, why are they doing what they are doing every single day in training. And for me, the why has always been very clear. And that I wanted to win an Olympic medal as a player, and I was shattered when I couldn't win it myself. And now what drives me every single day is to ensure that the same mistakes are not repeated for the next generation of players. So yes, intrinsic, and I think building those good ecosystems motivate people to get better. Whether it's the coach is as part of the ecosystem, motivating the coach as well, motivating the support team around. So all of them need to motivate the player, and we need to ensure that the support team is also motivated.
Right.
So it's everyone feeding off each other. And as I said, it's building good ecosystems. Right now in India, the ecosystem is lacking. It's a ecosystem right now that is not conducive to excellence. And we need to bring the right, I always believe in good people, so I've been always very careful in selecting the right people around my athletes.
And what's the delta when you move from being best in the country to being best in the world? What are the areas where, double click on the word excellence in that context for me, right?
So again, sport is not really a rocket science. And it's like what Germany does in hockey. If you see one-on-one, maybe they're not as skillful as Indian or Pakistani players. But again, the sum of their parts of the team is, it's a superb team. And that's because they do the simple things very, very well. The 95%ers that they do is, they keep it very simple, very basic, but they do that brilliantly. No one can touch them on the simple things like their passing, their trapping, their fitness, their speed, their nutrition, their video analysis. And that's far ahead of all the other teams. So we might beat them on skill, but that is not, they have taken away that element from the game.
Equation.
So even if they have taken it out of the equation. So even if India does that better than them, it's not enough to match that other gap. So I think as far as possible, we need to do the simple things well. Sometimes we forget to do the simple things well, keep the basics really strong. Mm. We are trying to do always the wonderful, brilliant moves, and we forget to actually stick to the basics and keep that simple. Once that is in place, then you move on to the next thing to look at the finer things. But if we don't do the simple basic things well first of all, so, and that's why I say the system is not conducive to doing even the simple basic things. So other nations in the world actually sometimes laugh at us that on the quality of our coaches, the trainers and physios and nutritionists. These are actually basics in sport. But we are starting at this now at when our athletes are reaching India level. But yeah, it needs to be done when they're 12 years old.
Mm.
So that's what we need to do much better as a nation.
Got it. And I want to pick up on the theme coaching. And again, given that you work with several athletes now, and a lot of the coaches, I'm sure, are ex-players. What's the delta again from being a good player to a good coach? And where do you see people effectively making the transition, right? So that's sort of question one. The other piece I'm also curious about is how you pick a coach, just like how you pick an athlete to back. And just to make it real, if we pick two well-known names, Saina Nehwal and PV Sindhu, I guess it's each one requires a different type of coaching support. So give us an insight into what makes good coaches, specifically when people are transitioning from being a player to a coach. And second is, how do you pick a coach in the context of a player?
Yeah, so I'll answer the second part first.
Sure.
How do you pick a coach in context to a player? So I'll answer it with Mary Kom's example.
Sure.
In 2009, women's boxing was introduced in the London 2012 Olympics for the first time ever.
Mm-hmm.
Mary was already a 5-time world champion winner, but in the 46 kilo grams weight category and 48 kgs, mm-hmm. her last one.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when women's boxing was announced in 2009 that it would be for the first time in the London 2012 Olympics, before that boxing was only a men's sport.
Okay.
But the least weight category for women was 51 kilos.
Mm.
So that means Mary Kom, who was originally a 46 kg boxer, had to move into 51, which is 2 weight categories higher.
Hmm.
It had been unheard of for a boxer to go 2 weight categories higher and win an Olympic medal.
Wow.
Now the challenge was, because when you're fighting in a weight category, not only you need to put on the right kind of weight, but you're fighting against taller opponents.
Sure.
Which is a major technical challenge in boxing. If you're fighting against taller opponents, that's a big challenge.
Hmm.
So we researched a lot and found out a coach by the name of Charles Atkinson, who specialized in taking fighters up weight categories.
Fascinating.
And making them into world champions. So that was the context of how
we researched. It was a very specific developmental need, and you sort of got a coach for
that. Yes. So he specialized in taking fighters up weight categories.
Hmm.
He understood the requirements. He understood the training needs, specific training needs behind taking fighters up weight categories, and the challenges of fighting against taller opponents, etc.
Got it.
That was one. About identifying talented coaches in general, that would be the basics, right? About seeing their track record, seeing their temperament, looking at the temperament of the players. Because very often, especially in shooting, one coach might be liked by one shooter, but the same coach would not be liked by another shooter, because technical skills within the same event, say a 10-meter air rifle and shooting, are very different.
Mm-hmm.
And so for Gagan Narang, that coach might really work for him, but the coach might not be work for another 10-meter air rifle shooter. So you got to match all this. Shooting is uniquely a very individual sport. And you need to identify, because while some say that coach is good for their technique, the next shooter says that he's tampering with my technique. So we need to be very careful and constantly monitor very carefully, take feedback from everyone concerned, and arrive at a sort of stage where you feel that everyone is benefiting with the relationship.
Got it.
But it's a constant process, and good monitoring, good relationships, good communication is critical.
And And it's easy to measure the performance of a player, but it's often much harder to measure the effectiveness of a coach. So is there a certain way in which you go about doing it at OGQ?
It's difficult to measure the performance of a coach. I would say it's even more tougher to measure the performance of a mental coach.
Correct.
Mental training coach.
Exactly.
And sports psychologists, etc.
Exactly.
Because if the athlete wins, then everyone says, you know, yeah, everything is working damn well. And if they lose, then you're finding people to blame and things that went wrong. So
true.
So yeah, so in general, in the long run, the results do count.
Sure.
I wish there was another route.
Sure.
But you tend to know when a boss or a coach is bringing the best out of you, whether he or she is motivating you every single day, whether he or she is teaching you new things, whether you're finding the training session interesting, you're improving, you're learning new skills, you're improving on your existing skills.
Hmm.
So you need to look at all those factors. But yeah, hard to measure, hard to really put very strong metrics in place for
true.
Every single thing.
Of course.
And yeah.
Got it. Moving on, I want to pick up on a different theme that I think sports is a great place to learn from, mindfulness. And I bring up mindfulness because we live in a reasonably distracting world, digitally distracting world. And when I look at sport, you know, when you're facing, let's say, if it's tennis, you're in championship point, either on your side or other side, or let's say one or two rallies away from winning the tournament. How do you stay present? How do you stay in the moment? Or when you're taking a penalty corner as a hockey player? So any lessons on how this muscle can be built? How do sportsmen build that ability to be present in that moment and keep everything, every other noise out of the equation?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not exactly sure that I have the right answer for that. But one is obviously you need to know what are the important things for you in life and what really matters to you. And when I was playing, for example, I was extremely focused. I've always done very few things in life, but when I did it, I make sure I did it 100%. And playing the match was, every single international match meant the world to me. And so I remember when I was captaining the first time, India for the first time, we were playing at Chandigarh. It was an India-Pakistan series. And you walk out of the dugout of the stadium and 50,000 people stand up and cheer for you. And the national anthem is sung and you get goosebumps on your hand. But I used to be so focused. So when the match started, the crowd is roaring, but I never heard anything. So I was just focused on match. So it's about just knowing what is important to you. And for me, that match was important and everything else did not matter to me.
But anything you would do you spoke about, for example, the Australian team training for 1.5 hours, but that being a lot more intense and sort of closer to the match experience as compared to 8 hours of less intense practice. I'm just curious about during moments of practice, if there was a way in which mindfulness can be cultivated. So do sportsmen go through a ritual?
I would say sports persons are the most superstitious of the lot. It's not exactly scientific.
Uh-huh.
But everyone has his own space or method of getting into their zone.
Okay.
Some are the more outgoing ones and, they want to listen to music which the rest of the team don't want to hear. And some retreat into their space. You got to respect that space and you got to find what works for you best.
Got it.
So that would really vary from individual to individual about what gets you. I'm the kind of guy who would always like to retreat quietly into my space before a match. Or today, if I'm giving a talk, maybe even if it's just 5 minutes with myself and think about what I'm going to say or
sure.
what I want to get across. Good planning does help.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least having a little bit of an idea of what you want to do. I think that can help a little.
Got it. That's great, Viren. this podcast is titled Play to Potential, which is about individuals finding what they have potential for and playing the best game possible. So in summary, any themes you want to leave the listeners with for them to play to the potential?
You know, I think OGQ is exactly in the business of playing to your potential, because Geet Sethi says, if all our Indian athletes actually play to their potential when it matters at the Olympics, India would win far more many medals.
Sure.
And you know, that's what OGQ tries to do, to help our athletes reach their potential.
Hmm.
And one of my personal mottos in life is to have the courage to succeed. It's far easier to give up and to say, I've lost and everyone is against me and everything is against me and there are too many challenges. And it's far easier to grumble and criticize. It takes much more courage to actually do an inch forward and then eventually succeed. So, I just want people to have the courage to succeed in whatever they are doing in life. And maybe then our country would become a far better nation if we concentrate all our focus, our energies on playing to our potential.
Right.
I want to take this opportunity to maybe tell people to, in their own little way, to make a difference to sport and support an organization like Olympic Gold Quest. There are a lot of young athletes out there coming from maybe not so well-to-do backgrounds, but they're super talented. They have the potential to win medals for India at the highest stage and really make the entire nation proud.
Absolutely.
And sport has the power to cut across barriers, religion, caste, creed, get everyone together. And sport has the power to teach so many life lessons that probably the classroom cannot teach. And we must make sport a more integral part of our education. And I want people to support Olympic Gold Quest. It's an organization that has, I can assure you, if I may say so myself, that has credibility, transparency, and is showing impact. So we need to give the opportunity to those kids. So do support OGQ.
Absolutely. It's really inspiring, the work you're doing at OGQ. So we wish you and the OGQ the best and look forward to many more medals at the Olympics. Thank you so much for being generous with your time, Viren.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
Pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
I hope you found this conversation purposeful. I look forward to having you at one of the subsequent conversations at the Play to Potential podcast series. For accessing other nuggets or interviews, please visit audioboom.com and look for Play to Potential. And if you're an Apple user, the podcast is now available on iTunes as well. Thank you for listening. Bye now.